noise must be made. The prospect of a nap appealed, merely a nap, with Charlotte, behind a locked bedroom door. Must they? He will never be a duke, thank God, Charlotte said, easing away. But this whole valley will know you for the gentleman you are, if I have to dance with every one of their spotty sons to make it so. A gentleman. More to the point, her gentleman. Maybe that was as good as being duke, or maybe it was better. Chapter 9 Charlotte's husband had parted from her at the front door with a maddeningly perfunctory kiss, but then the butler had stood not 6 feet away, holding Sherborne's hat and gloves. Mr. Sherborne, for all his way with a passionate kiss, was dignified, for now. Marriage to a Wyndham took a toll on any man excessively attached to decorum. "Will I do?" Charlotte asked, surveying her reflection in the bedroom's cheval mirror.
"You'll do splendidly, ma'am,"
Halewyn replied.
"That's a very fetching carriage dress. My hair gets all afright in this damp. But you don't have that problem."
"I do, but one must persevere in the face of challenges." Halewyn's comment brought to mind a missing amber hairpin. 11 was a bothersome number when, for years, Charlotte had managed with 12. She'd taken to using her nacre set until she could find the 12th amber pin.
"Halewyn, where might I safely keep a small sum of money, or other form of valuable?"
Charlotte would never have posed that question to a London servant, even a retainer of long standing, absent exigent circumstances. All of the Mrs. Wesley's circumstances were exigent, however, and needs must. Halewyn left off rearranging bed pillows.
"Whatever are you asking, ma'am? Nobody in Mr. Sherborne's stuff would steal from him. That would be wicked and stupid."
Halewyn's expression bore consternation, also a hint of suspicion.
"I may want to surprise Mr. Sherborne," Charlotte said, "with a nightgown I've embroidered for his enjoyment, or with a new cravat pin that matches his eyes, for such gifts to be effective. I need a private place to store personal items."
Lying had never been Charlotte's strong suit, and Halewyn's frown said she wasn't convinced.
"You could use a hat box. No man troubles himself to look in hat boxes."
"An excellent suggestion, and you remind me that I have the perfect bonnet for this dreary weather."
Charlotte sent her maid into the dressing closet to rifle through the hat boxes. Why had she asked Halewyn such a question? She ought to have solved the dilemma herself, of course, or, as a last resort, prevailed upon Elizabeth for help. The lanes were muddy, so the trip to Haverford Castle was undertaken at a frustratingly decorous pace. The groom, driving the gig, refused to proceed at anything faster than a walk, lest the mud fly up and ruin Madam's cloak. Sherborne's servants were either devoted to him, or terrified of him, perhaps both. As the gig rounded a bend, a woman came into view, walking alone beside the road. She wore a plain brown cloak and plain straw bonnet, and carried a covered wicker basket over her arm.
"Give her room," Charlotte said, "or she'll be brushing the mud from her skirts for the next week."
The groom, who'd been introduced to Charlotte as Morgan, attempted to steer the carriage to the side, but the lane was ancient, with high berms both left and right.
"Good day,"
the woman called in cheerful Welsh. She was young, dark-haired, and sturdily built. Her most striking feature was her friendly blue eyes. Fern had had such eyes.
"Good day," Charlotte replied. "Morgan, a moment, please."
The coach rolled to a stop between puddles.
"I'm Clara Macpherson," the woman said. "My father is the vicar. You must be the new Mrs. Sherborne, and you will doubtless be appalled at my lack of manners."
Civilities in the countryside were vastly less bothersome than elsewhere.
"I am Charlotte Sherborne, Miss Macpherson, and we must contrive, when nobody is on hand, to make introductions. Are you bound in our direction?"
The groom cleared his throat.
"That depends on where you're going," Miss Macpherson replied. "And don't look all sniffy at me, Hector Morgan. Visiting the less fortunate is our Christian duty.
If you say so, Miss Macpherson.
Morgan's words were deferential, while his ironic tone argued the point.
I'm bringing honey and tea to a neighbour, Miss Macpherson said. I've only another mile or so to travel.
That mile will be muddy going. Morgan, please assist Miss Macpherson into the gig.
The groom heaved a put-upon sigh, wrapped the reins, and hopped down. Miss Macpherson passed Charlotte her basket, laden with bricks from the weight of it, and climbed onto the bench.
"Very kind of you, Mrs. Sherborne," Miss Macpherson said. "I've avoided a soaking so far, but the sky promises more rain.
This is Wales. Without the rain, the land couldn't be so beautifully green.
With that attitude, you'll get unwell here. Everybody's dying to meet you."
Charlotte was not dying to meet everybody, though for Sherborne's sake she'd become the most gracious hostess in the valley if need be.
"You must assist me," Charlotte said,
for a vicar's daughter knew every household in the parish.
"Upon whom should I call first?"
As the horse plodded along, Miss Macpherson verbally sketched a whole rural community. The Duke and Duchess of Haverford sat at the apex of the valley's society, though the Marquess of Radnor and his lady, Haverford's sister, were also much respected and well-liked. Beneath the Duke and Marquess were squires and farmers, the old feudal pattern in a modern setting. The village included various trades, a blacksmith, carpenter, apothecary, bakery, and the usual assortment of lesser commercial establishments.
"We also have a lending library, of course," Miss Macpherson said. "Her Grace stops in frequently, though she delivers books more often than she borrows them. But then she's your sister. You'd know that about her."
"Her Grace has made lending libraries a passion, and enlisted my husband's support for her cause." Charlotte made that comment in hopes Miss Macpherson would pounce upon mention of Sherborne, for he'd been notably absent from her recitation.
"Her Grace was clever, putting the Sherborne resources to use in such a fashion," Miss Macpherson said. "We were all pleased to see her pull that off. Hector, I'll get down at the crossroads."
Pull that off? As if Sherborne's coin was hard to access, despite the fact that he was sinking a fortune into a local mine.
"Miss Macpherson, my husband would like to remark the occasion of our marriage with another charitable endeavour, besides the libraries he's financing all over Wales. Can you suggest a suitable gesture? He wants to undertake a project to benefit the whole community, something in addition to establishing a model colliery."
One, he'd said, would not make him rich, but would be managed according to enlightened standards established by the damned Duke. The dear Duke, rather.
"A charitable endeavour?"
Miss Macpherson asked as the gig slowed.
"You mean, like purchasing new hymnals?
No denizen of Wales over the age of 7 needs a hymnal. Something enduring. As a marriage should be."
"Haverford keeps most of the valley in good trim," Miss Macpherson said. "He sees to the roads and ditches about his estate, which is the majority of the arable land. Lord Radnor's papa bought us an organ not 14 years ago, so we've no need in that direction. Perhaps you might walk with me for a bit, and we can discuss this topic further."
The crossroad was a quagmire. "If you've only a short way to go, we'll take you." Morgan apparently knew Miss Macpherson's destination, because he took the left turning and drove on in silence for a few hundred yards, then turned again onto a narrow pair of ruts barely deserving of the term lane. He handed Miss Macpherson down at a small stone cottage with a thatched roof and a door bearing a peeling coat of red paint. A waist-high stone wall surrounded the yard, though no chickens were in evidence.
"Who lives here?"
Charlotte asked, as Morgan handed her down.
"Maureen Caerdenwall and her mother," Miss Macpherson said. "I'll not be introducing you."
A baby's squall pierced the chilly air. A healthy child, though not at the moment a happy one.
"I see."
Miss Macpherson's gaze was not so friendly now.
"She's 16, Mrs. Sherborne, and took her first job in service in Cardiff, working as an upstairs maid for a man who owns several ironworks. Somebody has to support Mrs. Carden, Wall, because her husband and son were both killed in the mines over by Swansea. Maureen came home in less than 6 months, and 6 months later the baby showed up. That was in spring.
To lose a father and a brother, and one's respectability.
And the child? 1/2 year old, more or less. A boy.
The baby had stopped crying, and a curtain had twitched. The household had curtains. The yard was tidy, the steps swept, the roof in good repair. This had been a respectable household, until some iron nabob hadn't been able to keep his footman, or himself, or his son, in line.
"Has she told you who the father is?" "He promised to marry her, a rich man like that, twice her age and more. He was lying, of course. Maureen is a hard worker, not that bright, and too pretty for her own good."
"She wouldn't be pretty for long, not trying to eke out an existence with no help and no coin."
"Who owns this land?" "Griffin St. David, the Duke's younger brother. He's different, I know. I am fond of Lord Griffin."
Some might call Griffin simple, but to Charlotte he was honest, friendly, kind and decent. Very decent. He was likely charging the women no rent. Hector Morgan stood by the horse's head, his expression severe. He might not personally judge Miss Caerdyn Wall for her fall from grace, but if Sherborne disapproved of this detour, Morgan could lose his job.
"If I weren't married..."
But Charlotte was married, and Sherborne's standing in the community mattered to him, as it should.
"I would not want to intrude on the family's privacy without warning," Charlotte said, "because I am a stranger to them. I will send a basket to the vicarage tomorrow, and ask that you see it delivered, where it will do the greatest good."
The curtain twitched again.
"I can do that," Miss Macpherson said slowly. "I can do that as often as the need arises, Mrs. Sherborne."
Her gaze was more than friendly now. It was conspiratorial.
"My thanks," Charlotte said. "And you will consider what charitable project my husband might undertake, in addition to the libraries
and the mine." Miss Macpherson set down her basket on the garden wall.
"Something enduring. I will think on this, Mrs. Sherborne, and put the question to my father as well. But Haverford has always taken quite good care of us."
"By the grace of Lucas Sherborne's generosity."
"We can discuss charitable projects further when my husband and I call at the vicarage. Please give my neighbours my regards."
Miss Macpherson beamed at Charlotte, a blessing of a smile that turned a dreary day sunny, and reminded Charlotte very much of Fern Porter.
"I will do that. Good day, Mrs. Sherborne, and thank you. One does what one can, Miss Macpherson. My husband and I will call at the vicarage in the near future."
Not a word of the Carden Walls situation would be discussed at that visit. All would be tea and shortbread, the weather, and the latest local wedding. Miss Macpherson waited by the gate, while Morgan assisted Charlotte back into the gig.
"We put Miss Macpherson down at the crossroads," Charlotte said. "She insisted."
Morgan's expression eased.
"If you say so, mum."
"I do. And Miss Macpherson will say so too."
They rattled along in silence all the way to the castle drive. The sun made occasional attempts to poke through the clouds, but the overcast soon swallowed up errant sunbeams.
"I won't be long, Morgan. 2 cups of tea for you in the kitchen, and I should be ready to go."
"Very good, mum."
Charlotte wanted to spend time with her sister, of course, but she also wanted to get back to Sherborne Hall, where she would find the biggest basket on the premises, and set about filling it before her husband came home from the colliery.
"I'm sorry," Sherborne said, closing the front door on a sharp gust of wind. "I should have asked you when you'd scheduled dinner."
Charlotte did not look happy to see her husband, and Sherborne was guessing at the reason. Darkness had fallen before he'd left off tramping about the works, Hannibal Jones jabbering at his elbow. Charlotte whisked Sherborne's top hat from his head.
"Your apology is not accepted. I should have asked when you planned to return from the colliery.
She passed the hat to Crandall, then started on the buttons of Sherborne's greatcoat.
You are soaked to the skin, sir. Might I suggest a hot bath before we dine?
He'd fall asleep in the tub, had done so on many occasions, and awakened all the more stiff and cold, because Turnbull allowed foolish employers to reap the results of their decisions. My horse slipped in the mud and came up lame, Sherborne said, as Charlotte worked her way down the front of his greatcoat. I had to walk him most of the way back.
In the dark, in the cold, in the pouring rain, cursing like a schoolboy given extra sums to do in detention.
I'm more interested in food than a bath at present.
Thank goodness the beast didn't send you into the ditch. Crandall, you'll need to hang Mr. Sherborne's coat in the kitchen if it's to dry by morning.
Of course, mum.
And please have Mr. Sherborne's warmest dressing gown brought to the library. We'll take trays there, and a toddy wouldn't go amiss.
I'll see to it, mum.
She peeled Sherborne's sodden coat from his shoulders, and the chill of the unheated foyer penetrated to his bones.
The fire in the bedroom must be built up as well, Charlotte went on, for Mr. Sherborne will have a bath after we've eaten.
Very good, mum.
Don't just stand about looking dignified, Crandall. Please take Mr. Sherborne's coat to the kitchen this instant.
Crandall bowed and withdrew, the sopping coat leaving a damp trail on the carpet.
What are you grinning at? Charlotte asked, fussing with Sherborne's hair. You'd think he had nothing better to do than eavesdrop.
He doesn't. I don't believe anybody has ever scolded Crandall for looking dignified.
Charlotte kissed Sherborne's cheek.
Gracious, you're cold. I've been wanting to do that since you walked in the door, but didn't know if...
Sherborne kissed her on the mouth.
I've been wanting to do that since you knocked my arrow from its path at Haverford's house party this summer.
They stood smiling at each other until a shiver passed over Sherborne.
To the library with you, Charlotte said, taking his hand in a warm grasp. What did you and Mr. Jones get up to this afternoon?
Sherborne cast back over hours, spent arguing, explaining, and insisting. Haverford had given grudging support to the mine on condition that it meet high standards for safety, while Jones, veteran of years in the coal fields, knew every corner there was to cut.
I'll be curious to see what Brantford makes of some of Jones's reasoning, Sherborne said.
Charlotte had taken Sherborne's green dressing gown from the footman, held the garment to the fire screen, then wrapped it around Sherborne in place of his coat. The bliss of finally being warm, of having soft cushions to sink into, was exceeded only by the pleasure of hot soup and fresh, generously buttered bread, consumed while regaling Charlotte with the day's efforts at the works.
"Who is this Brantford?" Charlotte passed over another slice of bread. "You've mentioned him, though I can't place the name. Or is Brantford a title?"
"The Earl of Brantford has become a junior partner in the mine."
Sherborne dipped his bread into the soup, then realized his wife was watching him.
"Sorry."
"Mr. Sherborne, we are private, and you are famished. I'd rather you get some food into you than impress me with your manners. I like to dip shortbread in my tea."
"I'd like, given the circumstances, for you to call me Lucas."
2 hours from now they would be in bed, and he desperately hoped Charlotte had decided the occasion was right to consummate their vows. She'd threatened as much. Mrs. Lucas Sherborne was not a woman who made threats lightly.
"Were you named for Luke the physician?"
"I was nearly named for the fiend. I arrived to this world at the start of a new day. When I was placed in my mother's arms, she gazed out the window to behold the dawn star on the far horizon, and decided I should be Lucifer. My father persuaded her that a saint would be a more fitting namesake than a fallen angel. What of you?"
"Nothing so colourful as a biblical debate. I was named for the late queen, of course. Tell me about this partner of yours."
"He's forward-thinking. He agreed to my terms. And he has coin to invest. I won't make him enormously wealthy, but neither will I squander his money and disappear on the next packet for Calais.
"If you don't care to finish your soup, I'll see that it doesn't go to waste."
Another breach of manners, though Charlotte passed over her bowl.
"I wonder why I haven't heard much about Lord Brantford. Is his seat in the north?"
"It is, which is why he has experience with mines. God help me if he decides to pay us a call before I get Jones sorted out."
Charlotte tore a slice of bread in half.
"Pay us a call? We're to have a visitor?"
Shabby table manners hadn't caused her to blink, and she'd taken in stride a husband who twice neglected to appear on time for dinner. The prospect of a visitor had her sitting up very straight.
"He'll probably stay with Haverford, being titled, but I do respect when a man takes an interest in his investments."
"Does Lord Brantford have a countess? Children? If he's thinking to visit soon, I must have details, Mr. Sherborne. Guest rooms must be prepared, the wine cellar put in order, menus decided, a dinner party or two planned. Guests are not a small matter, sir."
Mr. Sherborne, spoken in that tone, did not bode well for the balance of the evening.
"You're nervous about having company?"
"We are newly married, and first impressions matter, as I suspect you know. Am I a good hostess? Do I set a fine table? Can I assemble a group of guests who are both lively and congenial, even when I'm new to the Shire myself? You don't undertake an investment without significant planning, and my role as your wife is similar. I will be scrutinized by Lord Brantford, and he will carry a report to his countess. She will have correspondence, and thus my reputation as a hostess will be established or doomed."
Sherborne had taken Brantford on as an investor, without thorough investigation. He'd had time for only the usual inquiries, and now, more than a week later, that decision resulted in unease.
"You think Brantford will carry tales because we married in haste?" Sherborne asked.
Charlotte took a nibble of her bread.
"We did not marry in haste, as far as anybody knows. I met you this summer, and many couples in polite society marry by special license after a short courtship."
Their marriage would be subject to greater scrutiny because Charlotte Wyndham had married down. Just when Sherborne had convinced himself that the difference in their stations didn't matter, doubt reared its ugly head.
"Don't fret," Sherborne said, cutting into a serving of steak. "If the weather stays this nasty, the roads alone will prevent anybody from journeying into the wilds of Wales. Did you visit your sister today?"
Charlotte recounted her visit to Haverford Castle, most of which she'd spent listening to Elizabeth discuss the infernal lending libraries. The moment had shifted, however, from a husband and wife enjoying a private meal at the end of the day to a wife humouring her thoughtless husband. Again.
"Shall I see to your bath?" Charlotte asked, taking the trays to the sideboard. "The water should be hot by now."
Sherborne was warm and fed, and had he been a bachelor, he would have stretched out on the sofa and drifted off after a long and tiring day.
"A bath would be appreciated."
Particularly if Charlotte was offering to attend him. Spouses did that for each other in some marriages.
"I'll let Turnbull know," she said, "and have the footman take these trays. Would you like another toddy?"
He'd like his wife to sit in his lap and kiss him until his eyes crossed.
"No, thank you."
"Good night, then. Enjoy your bath, Mr. Sherborne."
She withdrew on a soft click of the door-latch, probably off to drag Crandall into the wine cellar for a late-night inventory of the clarets.
"My name is Lucas,"
he muttered to the empty room.
"Not Mr. Sherborne, not husband, not sir. To my wife when we're alone late at night, I'd like to be Lucas."
"Good evening,"
Brantford offered the greeting with a slight smile, which his wife returned. They avoided one another socially, though occasional encounters happened.
"My lord, I hope you're enjoying the music."
Veronica was still pretty, still lovely even, but she was no longer dewy.
"I am very partial to a well-played pianoforte,"
Branford said. "And you, my dear?" Around them polite society gossiped, laughed, and watched. Branford and his countess were known to be cordially bored with each other. Her ladyship had failed to produce offspring, and thus her diversions were limited to the insipid variety. Poor thing.
"I thought the violinist was superb," Veronica said. "Would you like to sit with us?"
Across the room, her second cousin, Tremont, Viscount Enderley, nodded politely. Doubtless his mamma, the Viscountess, was at the punch-bowl, mentally assessing the settlements of any young lady who offered her son so much as a simper.
"I'd enjoy visiting with your family," Branford replied, "but I'm promised elsewhere, and won't be staying for the vocalists. Did I mention to you that I'm leaving for Wales next week?"
The notion had just popped into Brantford's head, and being a decisive person now was as good a time as any to announce his plan. He and Veronica saw each other infrequently of late, and keeping her apprised of his whereabouts was only courteous. Veronica studied her fan, which bore a painted image of pink roses, blue butterflies, and stylized greenery. She was a talented artist, and might have created the artwork herself.
"Shooting?" she asked.
"Some shooting, and I thought I'd look in on a colliery in which I've secured an interest. You'll manage without me, I'm sure."
She waved her fan gently.
"How long will you be gone?"
"A few weeks. I'll leave my direction, of course."
Enderley was in conversation with Lady Ophelia Durant. She dined on young bachelors at every opportunity, sometimes several at once, if rumour was to be believed. And yet, Enderley, while giving every appearance of attending to Lady Ophelia, was also casting discreet glances in Veronica's direction.
"I might travel with aunt and cousin down to Enderley House for a visit," she said. "The opening hunt is next week."
Veronica was happiest in the saddle. Perhaps equestrian pursuits had affected her ability to bear children. The quack had also mentioned that a bout of the French disease could impair a man's ability to sire offspring, but Branford had gone more than 3 years without any symptoms of that indignity, and he'd been careful to keep a distance from his wife when she might have suspected he was ailing.
"Autumn in the country has many charms," he observed.
Was Tremont's company among those charms for Veronica? She and her handsome cousin had grown up together. Perhaps she regretted choosing the Earl over the Viscount, or perhaps she hadn't had a choice. Branford had had a choice, and like any sensible man, he'd chosen enormous settlements at the first opportunity. He should have realized that Veronica's settlements were the last desperate show of bravado by a family that hadn't a clue how to manage their fortune.
"You wouldn't object to my leaving town for a time, my lord?"
Did she think he'd drag her along to Wales?
"Your happiness will ever concern me, my dear. I'm sure the Viscountess will be a congenial hostess. Why would I object?"
"No reason."
Must she sound so plaintive? Branford sought her every comfort, was never less than gracious in public, and only bothered her once a week for conjugal favours that, by right, were his any time he chose.
"I see our hostess over by the dessert table," Branford said. "She looks determined to end this intermission. Enjoy the vocalists."
He brushed a kiss to Veronica's cheek, a gesture of loyalty before the gossips lurking in every corner.
"Until Sunday, my lady."
Sunday night being their standing appointment in her ladyship's bed.
"I'll leave on Saturday."
Veronica was asserting her independence. She'd begun this amusing habit about a year ago, when she'd turned 25. Sometimes her tantrums manifested in bills from the milliner. Sometimes they took the form of Sunday night megrims, though not often. The lack of a child was his sorrow, but her shame, after all.
"Then I'll see you on Friday," Branford said.
Because if Veronica was inclined to dally with her cousin, any resulting child must at least in theory be Brantford's. To support that theory,
Brantford would do his wife the courtesy of swiving her before they went their separate ways. And if Tremont could get her with child, so much better, for Brantford would soon weary of trying. Chapter 10 Charlotte left her spouse's privacy to bathe in their bedchamber, because Sherbonne had not indicated that her assistance was needed or welcome. Perhaps Turnbull had been summoned, or perhaps Sherbonne had bathed himself, shaved himself, washed his own hair. A procession of footfalls outside the door of Charlotte's private parlour suggested the footmen were wheeling the tub away. She forced herself to concoct another week's worth of menus, then tidied up her desk, banked the fire, blew out the candles, and prepared to consummate her wedding vows. She stopped with her hand on the bedroom door latch, and chose not to knock. Please let this go well. The bedroom was warm, humid, and perfumed with the scent of floral soap. Few candles were lit, and thus Sherbonne made a contemplative picture, wrapped in his dressing gown in a chair by the fire.
"Are you waiting for your hair to dry?" Charlotte asked.
"I'm waiting for my wife to come to bed." Well, he'd apparently eschewed a nightshirt, for the V of the dressing gown revealed the bare flesh of his throat and sternum. She took two steps into the room, abruptly feeling uncertain and resentful.
"Shall we see to the consummation, Mr. Sherbonne?"
He rose, which made the dressing gown gape open farther. "Perhaps you're too tired."
"I am weary of the anticipation. These intimacies are a normal part of married life, and we've yet to tend to them."
He raised a hand to cradle her cheek, and Charlotte had to steel herself not to shrink away, which made no sense. She liked to touch her husband, liked knowing the feel of him, liked that she had the right to be affectionate with him. Perhaps that was the problem. She liked taking the initiative. Sherbonne stepped closer, bringing Charlotte the fragrance of freshly bathed male.
"I have a suggestion, madam."
Now she wished he'd toss a few orders at her. Undress, come to bed, hold still, though surely there was more to it than that.
"I'd be pleased to hear your suggestion."
"Feel free to revisit your decision at any point. That's my suggestion. Married couples do, if they're lucky, have regular occasions of intimacy, but we've yet to establish the habit. Perhaps approaching the challenge in steps will serve us better than attempting the whole endeavour at one go." The challenge? Making love to his wife was a challenge? Charlotte wasn't sure whether to be flattered or appalled, but Sherbonne was right. The next step was to change into night clothes, which he had been doing every night of her adult life. She turned her back and swept her hair off her nape.
"If you'd oblige."
His hand settled on her shoulders, shifting her so the fire's light would illuminate her hooks. Sherbonne's breath brushed at the back of her neck, a curious sensation.
"Was this why you paid a call on your sister today?" he asked.
"This?
Oh, this."
Elizabeth maundered on about what she calls her basic collection, a few books every library ought to have. One could not distract her from the topic.
One had tried, but raising the topic of the topic had proved impossible. Sherbonne continued right down to the bottommost hooks, which wasn't necessary. The sensation of his fingers fiddling with Charlotte's dress, even over the swell of her derriere, was unnerving.
"Haverford can probably distract your sister from her lending libraries with a single glance. One suspects they are in anticipation of a happy event."
Had Sherbonne kissed Charlotte's nape?
"You said you like children. Their graces will make you an uncle."
"I subscribe to the philosophy that a woman should thoroughly recover from a lying in before conception is risked again, though I do like children."
"Do you like me?"
He desired her, which was of no moment. Charlotte believed that men, young men anyway, could probably work up a case of desire for any comely woman. Her stays eased, and Charlotte turned to face her husband. This was, by any other name,
their wedding night, and she wasn't making the least effort to behave like a bride.
"I like you, Mr. Sherborne. I like that you are hard-working, patient, considerate, and not one to tax a lame horse merely to preserve your boots. I like that you don't waste food, and I admire that you have been so generous with your neighbours, despite their lack of appreciation. I like that you say thank you to the servants, and I am pleased beyond all telling that your staff respects you. That speaks volumes, particularly where the maids are concerned."
Sherborne's reply to her babbling was to take her in his arms. This embrace was different. Charlotte felt no circular bump where his pocket watch would have been. Her stays were loose about her middle, and thus her breasts were unconfined. She felt Sherborne's heartbeat, not as a dull concussion through layers of clothing, but as the palpable ebb and flow of life. He wasn't nervous, which was doubtless good.
"I like that you are fierce," he said, "that you don't suffer fools, ever. I admire your marksmanship with a bow and arrow."
Charlotte waited for more. She was very good at sums, competent at the pianoforte, fairly well read, but Sherborne didn't know these aspects of her. He was left to compliment the traits that others considered her shortcomings.
"Don't be anxious, Charlotte. Just be yourself. Scold and fuss. Give orders. Be blunt. What follows might not be wonderful in the first few instances, but it will at least be pleasant. We'll manage."
That he knew she needed reassurance should have been embarrassing, but Sherborne was her husband. The firelight brought out a wealth of fatigue in his face, also patience and affection. He was not nervous. He was determined that their wedding night go well, and thus it would.
"I'll get into my nightgown."
Charlotte would have moved to the dressing screen, but Sherborne stopped her with a hand around her wrist. He kissed her, a slow tasting that promised pleasure and yet more patience. Charlotte borrowed his patience when she wanted to dive beneath the quilts and pull the covers over her head. Crossing the room with her dress unbound was another new experience, and knowing that Sherborne watched her gave her the resolve to walk away slowly.
"Warm the sheets, please," she said. "Your hair is still damp, and I can't have you taking a chill."
He laughed, though she'd been perfectly in earnest. Charlotte made a thorough job of her ablutions, left her hair in a single braid, and donned her nightgown. The room was warm, and the bed was 8 feet away. She emerged from the dressing screen without the benefit of a dressing gown, and without any sort of plan for the next hour. Sherborne was also without benefit of dressing gown, and once again sitting in his chair by the fire.
"Ready for bed, Mr. Sherborne?"
He rose, his silk trousers riding low on his hips.
"I'm ready, Charlotte."
Ye gods, he was fit. His musculature formed a landscape, like a patchwork of rectangular fields on either side of the slight indentation down the middle of his belly. Chest, shoulders, arms, all were wrapped in sleek muscle and shamelessly on view.
"You look larger without your clothes," Charlotte said. "Why is that?"
He snorted.
"Maybe because part of me is larger when I'm about to be intimate with my wife."
"You are naughty."
Fatigue made his features sharper and his smile more piratical.
"Not naughty. Married. Come, be married with me, Charlotte Sherborne."
He held out his hand, and Charlotte took it.
"Does one undertake this aspect of married life, with or without one's bedtime attire?"
For if she enjoyed looking at him, perhaps he might.
That thought was beyond married.
Sherborne paused with her by the bed.
"Do you have a preference?"
"I've never done this before. How could I have a preference?"
Except she did have a preference. Sherborne took a step back, drew off his trousers, and tossed them over the privacy screen.
"Now, do you have a preference?"
Charlotte couldn't help but peek, then stare, then gawk. Sherborne was all of a rugged, healthy piece, The taut geometry of his belly flowed into long flanks and defined calves, everywhere lean, smooth, and male. And there, where the dusting of golden hair became a dense thicket, very male.
"You promise me we'll manage pleasantly?" Charlotte asked.
"I promised to worship you with my body. Being worshipped should be pleasant, Charlotte."
"Valid point."
"Then let's to bed, Mr. Sherborne."
"Lucas," he said, scowling down at her, "when I'm being worshipful, you will please call me Lucas."
Charlotte considered rejecting that order, but no. He was actually making a request, and a reasonable one under the circumstances.
"Lucas, dearest husband, please come to bed."
In the complete, glorious altogether, he made a circuit of the room, blowing out candles one by one. Charlotte regretted the loss of illumination, but appreciated her husband's respect for fire hazards.
"Shall I untie the bed curtains?" he asked.
"Yes, please. And then you can untie the bows of this nightgown."
Sherborne had fallen asleep in the tub almost as soon as he'd sunk into the hot water. He'd woken in time to wash before the water had cooled too much, but fatigue still wrapped around him like wet towels. Which was good. A husband consummating his nuptial vows ought not to be in a frantic rush. He should be relaxed, calm, and prepared to delay his own pleasure. Sherborne was as calm as possible, considering he had a cockstand at full salute and a willing wife parading around in a single layer of linen.
"Let's get comfortable beneath the covers," he said. "We can see to your nightgown later."
Charlotte shot him an exasperated look as she bounced onto the bed. Wrong suggestion, then. She'd offered to bear her treasures, and he'd bungled his response in aid of his self-restraint. Sherborne climbed in beside her and found another dose of cold. Some fool by the name of Lucas Sherborne had again forgotten to warm the sheets.
"Too much inspiration," Sherborne said, "and my self-discipline will fail us when most needed."
Charlotte scooted down and flopped to her side, facing him.
"Inspiration?"
"You," Sherborne said, kissing her on the lips. "Without your clothes, inspiration."
She smiled against his mouth.
"Like you without yours."
Charlotte was not a prude. She'd given him a thorough inspection as he'd strutted around the room, which had been the point of the exercise. That and the moment to think, to concoct a strategy. The only helpful notion to form in Sherborne's tired brain was an admonition from his grandfather, who'd been something of a rogue in his youth. The lady's pleasure must come before all else, or a fellow wasn't likely to get a second chance to impress her. So Sherborne devoted himself to kissing his wife. Charlotte was inexperienced rather than reticent, and she was a fast learner. When Sherborne slid a hand over her hip, she retaliated by pressing her palm to his heart. When he eased his tongue across her lips, she scooted closer and ran her toe up his calf. Sherborne trapped her foot between his legs, and she pulled his hair. Fatigue fell away, replaced by a compulsion to mount and start thrusting. But this was their wedding night, more or less, and Sherborne was determined to earn a standing invitation to Charlotte's side of the bed. He rolled to his back, taking Charlotte with him. She straddled him on all fours, not touching him, and once again looking impatient.
"You might have asked."
"Charlotte, darling wife, would you please consider settling over me such that I am surrounded by your abundant glories? I like having both of my hands free to plunder your charms, while you kiss me any way you please. I like your weight on me, your warmth pressing on me intimately."
She curled down to his shoulder, not fast enough to hide a smile.
"I have married a foolish man."
"An incompetent poet, but not a fool."
"Abundant glories, Mr. Sherborne?"
"These," he said,
palming the sides of her breasts.
"I'd love to worship these with my body, etc., if you're inclined to grant that boon."
Charlotte sat up, expression wary. She still wore her nightgown, though it was bunched at her waist. Sherborne lay on his back, hands resting on her hips. For the sake of the next 5 decades of marriage, he remained relaxed and still, though arousal had become a sharp ache. Slowly, slowly, Charlotte raised the nightgown over her head, then leaned forward to tuck it under her pillow. Before she straightened, Sherborne caught her breast in his mouth and slid his hands up her back. By touch, he suggested she linger in that position and learn the pleasure of her husband's teeth on her nipple. She sank closer, and he rejoiced. "Pleasant?" he asked, switching breasts. "Warm, sweet, soft, delectable."
"Married and pleasant."
She sounded a tad breathless. Erotic impressions piled up, the silky smooth contours of Charlotte's breasts beneath his fingers, the texture of a puckered nipple in his mouth, the throb of desire. An ambition landed amid all these pleasures, a determination that Charlotte get a taste of the destination before the consummation. More than a taste. Sherborne was her husband, very likely the only man whom she'd take as a lover, and he owed her that consideration. In a way that speaking vows or sharing a long journey had not, Charlotte's intimate trust struck Sherborne with the enormity of the commitment they had made to each other. They were husband and wife, joined for the rest of their natural lives. She was his and he was hers, and by God, he would make certain she was pleased with that bargain. He slid a hand down to her hip and around to pat her bum. "Time to enjoy a few more abundant glories."
"Must I? I was rather enjoying—"
He kissed her.
"Glories, Charlotte, plural. We have many more to sample."
She slipped to the side, brushing her sex over his rampant cock in the process. The haste with which she scooted away confirmed that the caress had been inadvertent this time. Give her a week, and with any luck she'd be driving him mad. Sherborne fixed his figurative eye on that prize and began rearranging pillows.
"What are you doing?"
"Embarking on an experiment."
He propped himself against the headboard, spread his legs, and patted the mattress.
"Let me hold you."
Charlotte had the covers drawn up under her arms.
"You want me?"
"Between my legs, using me as your personal chaise, your back to my front."
"And my hand between your legs." She remained right where she was.
"Why?"
"So I can worship you to the utmost."
Her expression turned mulish.
"When do I get to worship you? The vows were reciprocal, you know."
"Next time, Charlotte. If you want to worship me by taking a riding crop to my bare bum, or licking every part of me while I'm bound hand and foot, we can negotiate that later. This time is just for you."
She crawled over his leg, her breast brushing his thigh, then curled against his chest on her side.
"You say the most outlandish things."
Sherborne put his lips near her ear.
"You're interested in that bit about the riding crop, aren't you?"
"Don't be ridiculous. And I don't see the point of binding you."
She flicked her tongue over his nipple.
"The licking has possibilities. You taste like lavender."
Rather than let her tangle him up with more words, Sherborne cupped her chin and kissed her, while he used his free hand to caress her breast. Her weight pressed against his erect cock, a sensation he tried to ignore. By stealth, degrees, and determination, he eventually got Charlotte positioned where he wanted her, sprawled with her back against his chest, arching into his touch as he pleasured her breasts.
"You like this?"
She closed her hands around his, asking for more pressure.
"I haven't made up my mind."
"Then I must try harder."
He trailed his fingers lower until he was stroking through her curls.
"Relax, Charlotte. We're getting to the interesting part."
"This has all been very gracious, everlasting powers."
He'd found the seat of her pleasure, and possibly a way to have the last word at least some of the time. Charlotte squirmed. She wiggled. She sighed. She spread her legs over his and reached behind her to grab Sherborne's hair. He found a rhythm and a pressure that she could follow, and when Charlotte's hips were urging him faster, he resisted. Pleasure delayed was pleasure intensified.
"Mr. Sherborne."
"Lucas."
Silence for a few moments, while she probably fashioned an argument, and he added more pressure without speeding up.
"Mr. Oh, ye gods! Lucas! 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 Lucas!"
Sherborne cupped her breast and drove a finger into her slick heat, giving her some part of him to seize around. Her pleasure was intense and protracted, while Sherborne's was vicarious and bound in frustration. When he withdrew his hand, Charlotte curled sideways on his chest, her sigh fanning across his heart. His cock throbbed, his balls ached, his back wasn't exactly comfortable, and the room was gradually cooling.
"Charlotte?"
She nuzzled him.
"Hmm?"
He tucked the covers up over her shoulders, cradling her close. Sherborne cast around for the right words, the right question. Charlotte had given him her trust in a way that mattered, and he wanted to tell her something. When she'd recovered, he'd make sweet, slow love with her, and ease her the last distance down the path to marital intimacy. They'd fall asleep, entwined, and in the morning share smug smiles over their tea and toast for the rest of their lives. Tenderness pushed arousal aside an inch or two.
"Charlotte, did you find it pleasant?"
Her breathing was regular, and she was a warm bundle of wife against his chest. Sherborne waited for her answer, doubtless something honest, original, and accurate. But still Charlotte remained silent.
"Charlotte? Mrs. Sherborne?"
Sherborne fell asleep, waiting for his wife to wake up and answer a question that mattered to him far more than he'd thought it would. When he did awake, weak sun was filtering through the curtains. He was spooned around his wife, and some fiend was rapping incessantly on the door.
"Sir, you must wake up,"
Turnbull shouted. Sherborne forced himself to awareness, because Turnbull never shouted.
"Sir, you must wake up. There's been an accident at the mine."
The colliery looked the same from a distance. Only as the landau wheeled closer could Charlotte make out men digging at a huge heap of hillside that had come slouching over the retaining wall. The wall was no more, buried under tons of mud. The neat rectangles of twine that had marked out the longest row of houses had been obliterated as well, while the rest of the site remained unchanged. The sun chose now to shine so brightly as to hurt Charlotte's eyes, though the breeze was cold. That chill reinforced a sense that she should not have come, should not have intruded into matters she knew so little about.
"Pull up next to the large white tent," Charlotte said, "the one all the shouting is coming from."
In the privacy of their domiciles, Wyndhams occasionally raised their voices, though Charlotte did not deal well with being shouted at. Sherborne had left the house within 10 minutes of waking, Turnbull at his side, while Charlotte had stood about in her husband's dressing gown and worried. An hour later somebody had sent a note, "No fatalities, extensive damage." Charlotte thought she recognized Sherborne's handwriting, but the only time she'd seen it previously had been when he'd signed documents following the wedding ceremony. An hour more of pacing and fretting, and Charlotte had made up her mind to cease dithering and do something.
"Helwyn, are you and Morgan see to the food?"
One of the tent flaps had been tied back. Inside, Mr. Jones was marching about and waving his hands, while Sherborne stood with one shoulder against the central tent pole. He wore no cravat, no top hat, and his boots were caked with mud.
"Hillsides do as they're damned well please," Jones said. "We build walls, and God laughs. If I'm tempted to skimp on materials, I'll skimp on the materials for the damned palaces you want to build for your workers.
not on the simplest wall ever to be overcome by mud.
Sherborne visually tracked Jones's peregrinations, while Charlotte slipped into the tent. Piles of paper she'd tidied and organized on her last visit were once again in disarray, with stacks held down by rocks, a pen tray, an abacus, and other makeshift paperweights.
If that wall had chosen to give way later this autumn, a dozen households would have been buried in mud, Sherborne said. How can I trust you to build a safe mine when you can't manage a single retaining wall?
Jones strutted up to him.
I told you when I signed on here that I'm a mining engineer, not a perishing architect. I deal with the insides of the hills, not a lot of bloody landscaping.
Charlotte let the foul language go unremarked, for at some point in this altercation Mr. Jones had unearthed the calculations upon which the construction of the wall was based. While Jones ranted about timbers and cross-stabilization, she took a seat and studied the figures she'd found under an unlit carrying candle.
"The men can live in damned tents," Jones went on. "You don't need to build the houses before you sink the shafts. What kind of businessman builds a village before his colliery is making any money?" "One who wants his mine to attract only the best talent, the hardest workers, the most trustworthy crews in Wales. Why should any competent miner bestir himself to leave his post and join my crew, if I'm offering him less protection from the elements than I expect for my horse?"
"Why should he expect any different?"
Jones stuck his nose in Sherborne's face.
"You can find an experienced miner a whole lot more cheaply than you can a well-trained horse. A simpleton can work the mines."
"The men might disagree with you," Sherborne said, with ominous quiet, "though the next thing to a simpleton should have been able to design a retaining wall that held up for more than a few months."
Sherborne's words lashed the air. For the first time, Charlotte glimpsed why people gave her husband a wide berth. The view was intimidating, also impressive. Chapter 11. To Charlotte's relief, Mr. Jones had the sense to take a step back.
"I checked my calculations, Mr. Sherborne. I don't do shoddy work. I measured the land, did the math, and made allowances for the soil containing a disproportionate share of rocks, and then I used only sound timbers in sufficient quantity for the mass involved."
A silence stretched as Jones produced a flask and tipped it up to his mouth. "You did not account for the weight of the water in the soil," Charlotte said. "Your figures for the soil were likely correct, but water weighs on the order of 1,674 pounds per cubic yard. Mr. Sherborne's treatises all more or less agree on that figure. Your wall held up until the rains came in quantity." Both men stared at her. Mr. Sherborne in particular did not look pleased to see her, though if he intended to upbraid her for intruding into his business, he'd apparently do so at home behind a closed door, which was, in a way, worse. Charlotte held the calculations out to Jones. "You made no allowance for the incessant rain." Jones snatched the papers from her.
"The water doesn't stay in the soil. It percolates, drains down deeper into the earth, or evaporates." "With as much wet weather as we've had," Sherborne said, pushing away from the support, "the soil hasn't been draining. The lanes and pastures are full of standing water. Mrs. Sherborne's explanation makes sense, and rainwater probably isn't a factor in most of your subterranean calculations."
Jones set the figures aside.
"I am a mining engineer, and I stand by my figures. Why have those men stopped digging?"
Across the expanse of supplies, sitting under tarps, beyond the muddy lane, the men had jabbed their shovels into the great heap of earth and left their work.
"I brought food," Charlotte said. "Hot soup, bread, butter, cheese, and ale. I suspect you both could use some sustenance."
"I could at that," Jones
said, slapping a hat onto his head.
"A pint or three of ale won't go amiss either."
He stormed past Charlotte, and she was abruptly alone with her muddy, scowling husband.
"How do you know what a cubic yard of anything weighs?"
Sherborne knelt by a parlour stove at the far end of the tent and tossed more coal onto the flames.
"I barely know what a cubic yard of dirt weighs, and I own this colliery, such as it is."
He wasn't